or perhaps my touch on her wrist was merely her sort of tea leaves or crystal ball. The device that opened the channel. I preferred to think the former. For if my function was only as recorder of what was said, I shall claim a heavenly crown of patience. Even after the technique was established, I was often forced to sit for long intervals, holding Betty's wrist, while she was most happily busy at her own invisible affairs. But that is a bit ahead of the story. Though from the very first attempt Betty managed this slipping into the double consciousness quite easily, the other aspect, the reporting back, was a different matter. When she tried to tell me about it, whatever it was, her speech was halting, stumbling, fragmentary, almost to the point of incoherence. Obscurely, through that incoherence, I thought I caught glimpses of something important. But as compared to our easy, rapid automatic writing, this seemed to be a very ramshackle makeshift. Still, I was in it for the duration. Gradually emerged a reasonable explanation. In the automatic writing, Betty had been an amanuensis, had merely lent herself as a machine. Now she was to be brought into touch with realities, which she was to absorb and tell about. Also, as herself partaker of this superconsciousness, she would receive direct impressions, would hear words with some inner ear. While still in the supernormal state, she would bring down these things to that fragment of normal consciousness retained for the purpose, and through it report to me for record. That was the program, as I understood it, and it seemed both reasonable and interesting. She made quick progress. Soon she was able to tell me matters that made sense in what was gradually revealing itself as an ordered and progressive expansion of herself. And then once more, just as this method in turn began to be really useful, it was interrupted and something new attempted. We had no warning. On January 28, 1921, almost a year after the first Weir board trial, Betty withdrew herself into one of her patients' trying private sessions. All I got out of it was a fragment now and then of her side of conversations with her invisibles. I'd like to, but can I? How silly. Where do I find it? Will you show me? Tantalizing bits. Finally, after over an hour of this, she turned to me. They can't tell me what I'm working toward because they cannot tell yet what I'm capable of developing, said she. They can't predict, it all depends on me. They want me to do regular laboratory work, but how can I question mark how they shove? She cried. How they shove me. My, what a force they're putting behind me, pushing me on, exclamation mark. My other consciousness with you is slipping, slipping. I'm just barely conscious whether I'm talking or not. It's a new phase. I don't want to lose consciousness. She was immobile and silent for 13 minutes. Then she sighed deeply and slightly moved her feet. I can move now. Rouse me. It is all over for tonight. What did they do to me? I was holding intercourse with somebody, but it did not get back to my waking consciousness. I shook her wrist gently, and after a few moments she came back. Whether I liked this or not, I did not quite know. But Betty seemed no worse for it. On the contrary, her color was bright, her vitality increased. The following day's session began again with some private business which Wag not confided to me. I gathered that Betty was being persuaded to something. Oh, go ahead, I don't care, she muttered at one time. I don't know what you're doing, she complained. Oh, do be definite and don't muddle it, she cried. I'm not cross, she disclaimed. I've got to breathe. I don't believe it's going to work anyway, she protested. Well, I'll try. Then 10 minutes of silence. Suddenly a guttural sound in her throat, a pause, and the sound was repeated several times, until it extended itself into an almost recognizable word, grandma. After 10 seconds, very distinctly and clearly the two words Grandma White. But the voice that spoke them was not Betty's. By the same slow and painful process came my love, many more, the name Mary. And finally the beginning of a sentence, make her. It took just an hour for these few words, with a lot of underbreath rapid comment of protest and apology from Betty. At last she said to me, doesn't amount to anything. I wish you'd take me out. I'm tired. It is not coherent, and I cannot help it. They dull me and then do it themselves. After this she continued daily to work, and clearly and valuably, by her old technique of reporting back, from the other consciousness, in her own person, until February 11th, when a second attempt was made at what might be called direct transmission. Here is the entire result of something over an hour. Mary, rather hard, realize difficulties, give consideration channel, undeveloped. Progress slow, came explosively, as one word, s'era, m'il militate, aren't you sasf, meant for satisfied, probably, don't be so, here Betty broke in. Oh, I'm working so hard, why do I have to work so hard? Then, very slowly, with a pause between each word, but clearly, method new. No more now, good night. Wake up. Nothing happened for 5 minutes. Then Betty, to me, wake me up. I'm tired, shoving me around that way. I stopped breathing, but I found a new way to breathe. I felt it when it changed. I felt absolutely safe. It isn't uncomfortable unless you stop to think about it. If you don't think about it, you don't have to breathe. Everything swirled and swirled and rocked in a kind of rhythm. I felt myself to be more of a gas substance than flesh and blood. I was just vaguely conscious of trying to force out something, working very hard. She awakened presently, of herself, refreshed, without fatigue. Nothing further was attempted in the new technique until February 17th, though we had the usual sessions in that week. After this manner we continued, using Betty's old technique of reporting back in her own person most of the time, with an occasional laborious period of practice in allowing herself to be used as a mouthpiece. With such practice the difficulty lessened, the facility improved. But nothing important was said that way. Like the first of the automatic writing, the communication was largely personal, a phase almost completely abandoned in the other method. We cannot yet hold it steadily, long enough for subtle explanations. The invisible laboriously answered my query as to why this was so. Your receiving apparatus very primitive, excuse us. Not until about the 1st of May did those in charge consider Betty flexible enough to use for the transmission of anything seriously integral with the main effort. And I should think it fully a year thereafter before the interchange switched back and forth, from Betty in person to Betty as a mere transmitter, freely, without checks and stumbles. Until, in other words, the instrument was perfected. People have asked me how I knew, outside the context of what was said, when to ascribe to Betty, and when to the invisibles. Her voice was slightly different in quality and timbre. In the latter case, the phraseology was not of Betty's habit, but the most convincing, and at the same time unprovable, distinction was a decided feel of personality. That would, of course, mean nothing to anybody but me, and rarely, when it did not matter one way or the other, I was not myself certain. But ordinarily I was sure. I have also been asked about physical symptoms, as to Betty's condition while in this state of consciousness. It was obviously trance, but not complete as in the case of Joan, who actually seems to go away, leaving her organism to be used. Betty was supposed to work, said the invisibles, with intelligent cooperation. I cannot do better than to quote from the Betty book as to this. She was to go to them, instead of their coming to her. And as intelligent cooperation presupposes participation, her consciousness was not taken from her in the customary deep trance. That does not mean that she was conscious as you and I are conscious. She was unaware of her physical surroundings, she went out of her body, as the occultists have it, to some other phase of existence. But in that somewhere else she retained her faculties of thought. She was not put out, drugged. She was transferred, occasionally, but rarely and only for certain exact accuracies. She goes so far away, as it seems to her, that apparently there remains to her only a shred of our consciousness. But that shred is always there, and through it the approach to intelligent cooperation is always possible. It took about 5 minutes for her to become entranced, and about the same time to come out after the session was finished. I'm coming down like a leaf, zigzag, she once described her return to normal consciousness. I could see no physical change while she was in this state, except that her respiration became almost imperceptible. Nor did she ever suffer any ill after effects, even temporary. none of the nausea, dizziness or the like which some psychics undergo. On the contrary, she always awakened pink-cheeked and refreshed. Now, having finished the external mechanics of Betty's technical training, we are at last ready to backtrack and take up once more her beginnings, but this time from the point of view of the inner consciousness. Chapter 6: Betty Takes the Road 1. As I look back on these beginnings, I am reminded of the first handling of a skittish cult, and I admire the tact and skill with which the Invisibles did the job. They had, first of all, to get Betty's, and incidentally my, confidence. They must keep our interest, they must persuade her, and me, that the thing was worth doing, and finally must arouse a real desire on her part to go on. In consequence, the early communications were sugar-coated with personal matters. But, with the proportion of the latter gradually lessening, at last the personal was dropped with a finality that resulted in complete anonymity. Only when this was accomplished did they give us a glimpse of their own point of view. The content of first messages through news stations, explained the Invisibles later, 6 or 7 years later, after they had developed Betty as a reliable channel, is important only as it serves to retain interest and does not discourage by too complete irrelevancy. The Invisibles use the term station, or receiving station, instead of the usual medium because, they maintained, the latter has too many connotations. I rarely at first attempting to say anything. We are merely trying to get a reaction to stimulus. If this could be fully understood, it would be as effective to convey a single irrelevant word, or indeed mere meaningless sounds. From our point of view, the whole importance of a considerably extended period of first work is in the reaction on the part of the station to any impression. Often in a long-alleged message, a small phrase, a single word, or even a solitary syllable or sound is all that actually emanates from us with definite intent. The rest of the message, so-called, may be a mere going along with what the station himself unconsciously imagines to be the purport. Nevertheless, that bit of genuine response is entirely satisfactory to them, they went on to say, no matter how confused or false or contradictory the whole thing may seem to us. That is because their interest at the moment is in the process, and not in what is said. However, they admitted, as we at this end know nothing of the process, our interest is naturally in the content, and if that content becomes too nonsensical or unbelievable, we are likely to throw the whole thing overboard. So, they said, we give attention to accuracy, or what you call evidential, only when our hand on the pulse of your interest or belief indicates slowing down to a danger point. What we are after is not personal communication, but development of an instrument capable of something more worthwhile. This was a reasonable and logical explanation of the early puzzlements and bewilderments which Betty touched upon in her own narrative. But it could not be given at the time. She must at first gain her reassurance and encouragement as she could. Her Invisibles were very gentle with her. I am a friend, one told her, at the automatic writing stage. You can trust me. We will uphold and care for you. No harm can possibly come to you. Stuart must not fear for you. We solemnly promise him to guard you. We will make every effort to satisfy him. Only hold fast to our love for you and your faith will be justified. Never mind how discouraging the outlook is, continue to believe us. Do not ask explanations, only believe. And after a particularly confusing series of experiences, we have not forsaken you. But we are putting you more on your own to work. We do not want to foster dependence on us. Your unhappiness hinders. Throw it off. You have gone straight from being tired. Rest, and you will regain your outlook. Perhaps we have been too eager and pressed you too hard. Poor little girl, we are sorry for you and would comfort you tonight. Good night, dear. Are you happier now? We are as near you as ever, but we have strained you a little too much. Forgive us. Another time Betty had, evidently, been getting instruction beyond her saturation point. She blew up in a burst of laughter. So much preaching, she cried. I've never been so doggone good in my life. Why, I just take behind the ears being intelligent. And then went off in a schoolgirl giggling fit, renewed every time I tried to ask her anything. Now, said the Invisible, when at last she had sobered down, Perhaps you can rid yourself of the very self-conscious attitude we have been trying to point out to you. You were getting to be so busy with your attitude that you could not really listen to us. We are delighted to see you natural again. We do not want any solemn, virtuous feeling saint in place of a very human little daughter. The too hard pressure of which they spoke was an unremitting effort to arouse Betty's will to persist. At this time she was far from convinced and was easily discouraged. Ordinarily the stimulus of the invisibles was gently carried on by appeal to her trust and affection, or to her common sense and self-respect. "Do you wish to be spiritually illiterate?" they asked her. Betty did not grasp the connection. "If we can get it to you, you'll see the point," said they. "When you see a child learning to write, you know how hopeless it looks that it should ever be able to receive inspiration from the printed page. You are in just that stage, but you've got to stick to it. In fact, we are going to keep you to it. You've got to learn it sometime, just as you had to learn to write. Of course anybody, if he pleases, can remain spiritually illiterate, but then he will have to live a comparatively commonplace existence." I challenged this last. I could not see Betty as commonplace. By commonplace we mean keeping your approved boundaries beyond which you make no effort to go. By restricted imagination, by neglect of the unknown, by these you keep yourself commonplace. "But we have our ordinary daily lives to live," I objected. "It is not your application to little necessary things we worry about. It's the unbroken application. That's the thing that makes you commonplace. If you stop work, even drudgery, often enough, and switch your center of consciousness to big spiritual proportions, you can accomplish ordinary life without getting commonplace." This reasonable gentleness, as I say, was the rule. But at times they arose to an almost frantic urgency. "We lash you to our own frenzy of purpose for your own salvation. Make a vow to us to carry on our work. We cannot always come with the force of this evening, but we want these words to burn into your soul, to be your obsession, your ruling passion. Power wanes, and we want to leave you at our highest pitch of urgency, calling to the deeps of you to answer the great duty." Almost from the first hesitantly written words, the invisibles began to make it clear that they had in mind an important ultimate aim. Betty, it seemed, was to be made an instrument for some purpose not yet defined. We both possessed a healthy sense of humor, so at first we were inclined to treat such claims with skepticism and some derision. They perilously resembled these super solemnists specially chosen to bring a great message to the world, assurances with which we had become familiar through certain of our acquaintances who had stumbled on psychics. These experimenters seemed invariably to have been taken in charge by very important people, such as Plato or Aristotle or William James or even Julius Caesar and Nero. But Betty's invisibles had proved not to be so highfalutin. They did not pretend to be anybody in particular, and they had not as yet offered any message. It was merely that they had a purpose in training her, which was not so unreasonable when we stopped to think of it. "It's only," said they, "that we're giving you a little encouragement that you are more than a mere bystander taking notes. It's not a futile task. Once the interrelation of all created things is even dimly sensed, one cannot again be small. The mantle of magnitude is over the most humble part of the whole." What they wanted, they kept on repeating, was to teach Betty how to expand her consciousness. As a result, said they, she would become permeable to the invisible spiritual forces from which ordinary life insulates us more or less. This, for lack of a better term, they called contact with the source. Incidental to it would come an improved type of this thing they were now doing so imperfectly, communication from their world to ours. "We have been a long time planning this," said they, "so do not fool us. This is a great experiment for us. Much depends on you. It is the usual thing to have a person surrender all initiative as soon as we establish communication. We want you to gain strength from us, not lose it and become dependent. Involuntary mediums are good only as long as the conditions suit them. A voluntary medium in full control would be invaluable. We do not want to be too strong on this side because it is part of our scheme to have you do your share. We can write pages very fluently and easily when we wish, but it is safer to make you an active agent instead of a passive one." It was about this time, I believe, that they dropped the word medium as too full of connotation, and adopted the word station instead. About this time, also, Betty resolved to give these supposed invisibles a sporting chance. The expansion of consciousness desired by the invisibles turned out to be no simple task. Betty devoted an hour or so each day to following directions as best she could. But this, she herself confessed, was not very successful, for she could not make out just what was wanted of her. At first she struggled for a complete, clear-cut intellectual picture, largely, I think, so she could satisfy me. But the invisibles rejected the mental approach. "How can we bring to you strongly enough," said they, "the first principle of what we want you to do? It is to expand in spirit, not intellectually. The spirit is usually like a desiccated fruit inside the brain. We fear to give you too much for that reason. You are too much in your brain. Let your spirit soak up in a simple and pleasant fashion until it is a fitting mate for your brain." Such expansion, they asserted, would in due time result in the development of an entirely new faculty. "It is like learning another language," said they, "so you can listen to us with understanding. Each time you desire to travel beyond your present country, you must say to yourself, 'Am I thinking and listening in the right language?' Otherwise communication is hopeless." There was a pause, then Betty said faintly, "I'm going away off now." "This faculty," resumed the invisibles presently, "which we awkwardly call listening, thinking in another language, is an expansion of the progressive reality within you. You must strive for possession, as a subconscious fixture, of a faculty not sufficiently developed in you yet. Until you can absorb knowledge directly with this faculty, you will always be subject to dilutions, contaminations, dispersions. This absorption of comprehension, only partial of course, carried through the present channels of contact, arrives transmuted from the reality of the source into the symbols of the brain. It is almost useless to attempt much further extension of vision until you work out this faculty for receiving direct comprehension. The brain is a physical apparatus. It will always automatically take what it is able to absorb. But the inner expansive faculty, vigorously developed, can outrun the physical apparatus indefinitely." There was a short pause. "It is so discouraging," ended Betty, "now I see the double image at the water's edge, reality and reflection. They look just alike, but they are so different. I get the reality and take hold of it, but I only give you the reflection." Betty was really working very hard to do her share well and conscientiously. In fact, as it turned out, she tried too hard. "Don't strain in these efforts," warned the invisibles. "Keep the body relaxed, but free, and stimulate the spirit to respond with a great and rising wonder, similar to that inspired by the overwhelming beauties of nature. Unstopper your imprisoned spirit, let it rise blithely and naturally. Enjoy yourself. Don't strain. Let your heart dominate, and abandon yourself to its impulses. You will release yourself from terrible intellectual bonds, terrible, however, only when unbalanced. We want none of the usual abandoning yourself to outside influences," said they at another time. "It is all a matter of holding yourself together around a good firm core of aspiration and interest and aim as to where you are headed. And one more tip we want to give you," they added. "Run hard from the curiosity seekers who will try to make a gymkhana out of you. Don't let them even have a look in. Tell them anything you like, but head them off, for they will queer the whole thing in your mind if you will let them. In time you will have many clamoring after your help, but you must make them seek for themselves, not attach themselves to you like leeches." These and similar warnings were repeated again and again. They insisted that the usual morbid curiosity in psychics led to a byroad, or blind alley, from which Betty must be blocked. And another tendency of which she must be cured was over-eagerness. That was a natural mistake, once her enthusiasm was aroused for this fascinating exploration. The invisibles gave her some kind of a jarring, I don't know what it was. I knew there had been something startling going on. I asked Betty. "You see," she told me, "I was just slipping over when something happened, just at the wrong moment, and checked me back too suddenly. And I was so disappointed, so eager to go on, that I flung myself back absolutely wide open, tried to get myself back by an enthusiastic abandon, and that stopped the performance. That's what brought down on my head this warning stuff. No more going ahead under these false and dangerous conditions. False and dangerous conditions. We bad thought only vaguely of that aspect. And we had taken it for granted that we were going ahead, that we were on our way. Hadn't we agreed to give them a sporting chance? But to our surprise, to mine at least, it seemed that was not enough. We must actually enlist, and of our own free will, and with a plain statement of decision. Apparently we had not been called upon for it until sufficient demonstrations had provided materials for intelligent choice. Well, now we had them. And the Invisibles squarely called a halt. Escape, they pointed out, is not merely getting free. It is taking up responsibilities. Before going on with us, they continued, certain facts must be faced. You must pay a price to serve our cause. If you are to succeed, you must go into training. Are you willing to do it? We do not intend to interfere with normal life, but you must consecrate your spiritual life to us, and conserve its vitality and composure. Perhaps this work, if undertaken, will lead you into paths you do not wish to tread, but once started you cannot choose. You must take all or nothing, so do not draw back if we lead you to the edge and tell you to look. You will be tried in the fires of experience to see if you are fit to endure. This, I myself considered, must be Betty's decision, not mine. I felt that the expansion she had already gained must have sharpened her intuition to a sufficient wisdom. But secretly I reserved the right of veto should this mysterious warning uncover in her mind the slightest alarm or hesitation. She considered it carefully. I can stop where I am, mused Betty, where nearly everybody stops, with the comfortable crowd. But the compliment has been paid me of an opportunity to surmount normal boundaries, to accept the unillumined path of apprenticeship, wrenching myself free. Oh, the cost of the wrench. What the cost of the wrench would be she did not disclose, nor did I confuse the issue by inquiry. Questions sometimes make cross-currents. It is life, she reflected. And I want to get nearer, nearer to the source of all striving life. I want to smell the wet earth and feel the cool drip of rocks. I want to sway with the presence of the wind. That is all life, life. I want to keep close, close as I can get, to that. I want to sniff it, taste it, drink it, bathe in it. That's where I want to be. I don't like the dead things. Some people like intellectual conquest, mechanical things, making automatons, but I don't like that. I crave the live things, things endowed with self-structure. I want to get near enough so I can partake of the same great vitality. Throw open all hatches. I want to go out in the wind and the light and the air. I don't know what you call that current of vitality. Never mind its name, I'm going to get close to it. She fell into a long period of deep reflection. Suddenly she decided. Give me all of life before I leave. She cried passionately. All. All. I don't want a niche. Aren't there plenty of people to fill niches? Of course, they are happier in the peace of limited struggle. But I want most tremendously and vehemently the highest possible comprehension. I want to take the suffering and all. I don't care if it tears me to bits, I want it. I've made my choice. I don't care if it is hard. It isn't all suffering. The intensification of living is worth it. She had set foot on the road I know. Chapter 7 Seek and you shall find. From this high peak of exalted dedication the Invisibles yanked Betty down to consideration of the practical, rather humorously, I thought. All very well splendidly to defy unknown dangers. Any hero can do that. But how about the minor everyday penalties? They're afraid I minimize the price, Betty told me. The price? I queried. Solitude of association, said she. But I'm willing to pay it. I was still dumb. So they diagrammed it like this, nobody enjoys being considered queer, I was told, and what was going to be the use of all Betty's great efforts unless she came into the open eventually, and applied it in the world of daily living. The prospect did not dismay her, though it made her a little sad. What a pity if my friends misjudge me, she regretted. They could withdraw so much of the nice, Warm human interchange. I know there will be an assault of misunderstanding. They'll all be critical, I'm afraid, watching me in a suspicious way.